Hi, this is James Barris. I hope you find this talk supports you in your practice. If you'd like to support my teaching, you can use the donate button underneath my picture on Dharma Seed to do that. Your support is greatly appreciated.
Good evening. Well, we've gone through so many different instructions. You've noticed? Oh, what's it going to be today? Another one they're laying on us? Or, another one. What should I do now? And with so many different possibilities, the thought can easily arise, which one should I do? Well, which is the right one for me? Well, that worked pretty well last time. Maybe it'll do the same or even better. Or, oh, here's somebody, something new I can, maybe this one will work. The breath, the anchor, changing objects, choiceless awareness, vedana, intention. Should I stay with my emotions or come back to the breath? Maybe I should really be meticulous now and be, get in there with adhitana, resolution, resolve, determination. Oh, I think I need some space right now. So you might have some questions about the right practice or the right practice for you, or questions about practice in general. I had lots of questions when I was starting on this journey, this mysterious process, and I would badger my teacher, Joseph Goldstein. In those days, when after a talk, usually this teacher would stay and ask some questions and answer some questions. And he'd often see me. I remember one time he said, I think in good humor as I was coming up the aisle, oh, it's the nudnik. Yeah. Now, nudnik in Yiddish is a word meaning the bother, the one who's always pestering. And he said it affectionately. He wouldn't say something like that unless it was affectionate. I believe anyway. and he actually told me, and he shared this with others. He was a philosophy major in college at Columbia, and he had countless questions, always wanting to really understand. And when he learned meditation in Thailand, when he was there first for the Peace Corps, and then he got into meditation, he said, oh, this is so amazing, so cool. And he had countless questions, so many questions that when the monks heard that he was coming, some of them would stay away. Until they finally said, why don't you just sit and be quiet and watch your mind? Yeah. So this question of wanting to do it right, I wanted to address tonight. The right way. Or being afraid of doing it wrong, which comes up not uncommonly in practice discussions, because there's so many different approaches to practice. I mentioned in the last talk, I think there was the practice like your hair is on fire and heroic effort, and then there was the simple and easy, empty phenomena rolling on, all of that. So with so many different approaches, you might legitimately ask, what's the right one? And I wanted to share one that I didn't have time for, but I thought I'd put that into the mix, particularly for you over high achievers. Yeah. You low achievers, just watch your breath for the next few moments. And this is U Tejaniya, Burmese, great Burmese master, whose main practice is noticing our attitude in meditation. And I'll just read a few from his 23 points on right attitude. When meditating, both the mind and the body should be comfortable. I won't read all 23, but just a few of them. If the mind and the body are getting tired, something is wrong with the way you're practicing, and it's time to check the way you're meditating. Why do you focus so hard when you meditate? Do you want something? Do you want something to happen? Do you want something to stop happening? The meditating mind should be relaxed and at peace. You cannot practice when the mind is tense. You have to accept and watch both good and bad experiences. You only want good experiences? You don't want even the tiniest unpleasant experience? Is that reasonable? Is this the way of the Dhamma? Do not feel disturbed by the thinking mind. You're not practicing to prevent thinking, but rather to recognize and acknowledge thinking whenever it arises. So, a bit different from practice like your hair is on fire, isn't it? So, with all kinds of thoughts and ideas about the right way, just to notice how easy it is to believe in whatever your thought for the moment or the day about right practice, good practice. And the problem comes from believing our thoughts. This is from a Peanuts cartoon that I love. I saw it a while ago. Four frames. First frame, here I am, happy and content. Second frame, but not euphoric. Third frame, I'm no longer content. I'm no longer happy. My day is ruined. Last frame, I should have stopped thinking while I was ahead. And the Buddha recognized how slippery thoughts can be. And so he offered a number of different ways to work with thoughts. And I thought as the first part of this talk, I would share his teaching on different strategies for working with thoughts. This is the Vitakasantana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya, number 20, for those who like to look those things up. The discourse on the removal of distracting thoughts. It's one of my favorite discourses. It's a real practice and practical discourse. Bhikkhus, practitioners. When a practitioner is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time, they should give attention to five signs. And in the teaching signs, you can think of it as ways of thinking. What are the five? Here, when a practitioner is giving attention to some thought, and owing to that thought, there arise in them unwholesome thoughts, connected with desire, hate, delusion, then they should give attention to some other thought connected with what is wholesome. When giving attention to some other wholesome thought, then those unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned and subside. And with the abandoning of the mind becomes steadied. With the abandoning of them, the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. And then there's a simile for each of these strategies. Just as a skilled carpenter or their apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too when a practitioner gives attention to some other thought connected with what is wholesome, the mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Now, what does that mean for us here? You're in the middle of a particular thought that's caught you. Say it's a thought of anger. And he suggests, instead of, this is if mindfulness isn't strong enough for you to simply note anger, and hold it with a kind, compassionate awareness, these are these other strategies. Any idea what wholesome thought might be substituted or replace, knock out that coarse peg with a finer one? What might you reflect on? Anybody want to real loud so I can hear? Gratitude or loving kindness. Excellent. Okay, see? You have it right inside. So there you are. And then, may I be happy? Or you think of somebody who opens your heart, or you think of all the blessings in your life. Great. Suppose you have a thought of doubt. Any thought, any idea, what would be an antidote for the doubting mind if you can't just say, oh, doubt. Take a guess. What's that? Faith. Sure, exactly. Something that brings you faith, maybe an inspiring teaching or teacher or something that you've read or something or somebody's example that you've seen or somebody who believes in you even when you have a hard time believing in yourself. So there's antidotes for all of the hindrances. And this, he says, that's a skillful thing to do. You're stuck and you can't just be mindful of it. How can you substitute or replace it? But then he says, this might not work. Very practical, realistic. So he says, well, try this. Number two. If while giving attention to another thought connected with what is wholesome, there still arise unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion, then one should examine the danger in those thoughts. Thus, these thoughts are unwholesome. They result in suffering. And when they examine the danger in those thoughts, then these unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion are abandoned and subside. With abandoning, the mind becomes steadied, internally quiet, brought to singleness, and concentrated. And here's the image. Just as a man, woman, person, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around their neck, He didn't hold back at all. So too, when a practitioner examines the danger of those thoughts, don't go there. The mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. You know that. I'm sure you've raised it yourself at times. Don't even go there. That's a skillful technique. Uh-oh, I know where this is going. It's every time I've gone down this rabbit hole of John thoughts, relationship thoughts, or work thoughts, I know where this is going. And maybe 2 hours later, I might come out of it. He said, just wait. Don't go there. Examine the danger of going down that path and then come back. But might not work. Number three, if while examining the danger of those thoughts, there still arise unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion, one should try to forget those thoughts and not give attention to them. When trying to forget them, not giving attention to them, then unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion are abandoned and subside. With the abandoning, the mind becomes steady, quieted, concentrated. Just as a person with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut their eyes or look away, so too, when a practitioner tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Now, what does that mean? This method is sometimes called forgetfulness and inattention. And this is the Buddha recommending don't pay attention. Don't get lost in that. So what could that mean? Practically speaking, suppose you are caught in some kind of an unwholesome thought or a bodily sensation that's really hard for you. He says, forget them, don't give them life, and turn your attention to something else that's happening in your experience right now. This is different than replacing by a wholesome reflection. This is seeing what else is there here right now. Suppose you are lost in your story, and then you realize, oh, wait a second, I'm just feeding that story by wanting to get rid of it or my reaction. What else can I pay attention to? And you might pay attention to something that's not activating. Maybe listening to sounds. It's a great alternative focus of attention. You can't catch sounds and it's very spacious. Or maybe it's just sitting here and knowing that you're sitting and feeling your hands or feeling your feet. Or maybe it's noticing a place in your body that's pleasant. So to just turn your awareness, whether it's a physical discomfort or a mental discomfort, see if there's something else happening in your experience right now that you can turn your attention to. This is skillful. And actually, if you stay with an unpleasant, say, sensation for a long time, if you have the energy, it can get very concentrated and you can even have rapture on it. But after a while, the mind can get fatigued or withered is a word that's sometimes used in the canon. It says, you don't need to wear yourself out. Forget attending to that and turn your attention elsewhere. With me.
but still might not work. Number four. If while trying to forget those thoughts and not giving attention to them, there still arise unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion, then one should give attention to the stilling of the thought formations of those thoughts. And when one gives attention to the stilling of the thought formation, then unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hatred, and delusion are abandoned. And with the abandoning, the mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, concentrated. And here's the image. Just as a person walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And they would walk slowly, and then they might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And they would stand. Then they might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? Getting better all the time. And they would sit. Then they might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? Sounds good. And they would lie down. By doing so, they would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a practitioner gives attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, the mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, and concentrated. This has a couple of different explanations. One is the most obvious one. If you're getting worked up, chill, cool out, relax. What can I do to just calm down, calm the system down, go for a walk, be out in nature, have a cup of tea, don't try to do anything, and just let yourself be at ease. And another definition of stilling of the thought formations, it's a little bit more, it's more subtle and nuanced, it's just seeing where those thoughts come from. They come out of nowhere, completely unbidden. And just to see, they just appear, are here for a while, and disappear. And when you can see the mysterious thoughts out of a place out of which all of those thoughts arise, and not get caught in the content, there's another, that can be a profound stilling. Oh, these are just bubbling up from the mystery. But still might not work. Ooh, going down. So what if while giving attention to the stilling of the thought formations, those thoughts still arise, those unwholesome thoughts still arise, then, and I say this with some caution, then with teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, one should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Whew. When with teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, one beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then those unwholesome thoughts are abandoned and subside. And with the abandoning, the mind becomes quieted. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, when with teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, a practitioner beats down constraints and crushes mind with mind, the mind becomes steadied and quieted internally and brought to singleness and concentrated. What is he talking about? Here you've been hearing about kind awareness for the last 2 weeks. And you have to realize a few things. First, the Buddha came from the warrior caste. And so there's a lot of that kind of warrior and conquering the mind images. The second is, this can be a useful strategy when employed skillfully. It can't be done with anger, but it can be done with firm, tough love that says enough, like a parent would stop a child running out into the street, no, or about to touch a stove, no, and say it very firmly, but saying it out of love. And maybe you've had that experience where you also have just been firm with your mind and said, okay, enough now. How many people have used this with positive results? So you can't keep on using it. If this is your first card, you're going to get exhausted quickly. But when all else fails, give yourself a good loving talking to that says enough. Okay. And then you can employ any one of those other ones, or maybe you have some for yourself. So there's because these are just five that the Buddha came up with, and there's many skillful means. The Buddha was called the master of skillful means. 84,000 Dharma doors, it said that he knew just how to reach somebody in a very intuitive, unusual way. And there's lots of different stories of the different methods that he used. So, what's the point in all of this? This is why I want to share this discourse with you. There's lots of different ways, lots of different styles and practices, as I mentioned before. Jack wrote a book, a great book, Living Buddhist Masters, 12 different Theravadan, Thai, and Buddhist masters saying, this is the way I do Vipassana. Some of them say, this is the right way to do Vipassana. Some of them say, this is my way of doing it. And you read, and he purposely juxtaposed one very contrasting style against another one. You read one that is just noticing the movements of mind in a very, very light way, and another warrior on the next chapter. And there's all different teachers who our teachers and teaching colleagues have practiced with. You know, you study with Pa'ok Sayadaw, and he's super deep concentration. And he's a wonderful teacher. And you practice with Utejaniya, who I read some of those 23 attitudes. What a different world it is. Or Mahasi Sayadaw, who says, note every moment. And then there's the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Chah, which is just seeing the mind that's holding on and letting go. Then there's also the influence of those and many of the teachers, myself included, studying with other non-Theravadan practices, non-dual practices. One of my teachers named Punjaji or Papaji, who said, meditation wears out the mind until it gives up. You know. But then he also says, ceaselessly scan the mind. Or the Dzogchen practices, great Tibetan practices that I read from that. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, already here in relaxation and letting go. Joseph wrote a wonderful book I highly recommend called One Dharma, where he writes it to sort out his own reconciliation with these different practices that had such a profound impact on him. And it comes from, the title comes from the Third Zen Patriarch, Verses on the Faith Mind by Sengstan, who says in that passage, there is one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the ignorant. There is one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the ignorant. So not to get so attached to one technique and say, this is the right one. So given that, we still come back to, who do you trust? How do you know which one is right for you? Or how do you know in the moment, what should I do? How do you know what thoughts to trust? That's what it really comes down to. And this is what I want to explore for the rest of the talk. How do you know? How do you know what thoughts to trust? Because there's lots of different messages that come through this mind. And some of them are right on, and some of them lead us to greater suffering and confusion. I think did I read from the Kalamas here? The Kalama Sutta, the discourse that really got me hooked. I said, I don't know about this stuff. And then the Buddha says to the Kalamas, they say, we have so many teachers coming through here, and each of them having their own description of what leads to awakening and to the truth. And now you're saying you have the holy Dharma that leads to the end of suffering. This is really confusing. And he says, it is indeed, Kalamas, to be uncertain, fitting to doubt, for in situations of uncertainty, doubts surely arise. You should decide not by what you've heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on the texts, not because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher. But when you would know for yourselves that these things are unhealthy, these things, when entered upon and undertaken, incline towards harm and suffering, then, if you do not want to suffer, you should reject them. And when you know for yourselves these things are healthy, these things, when entered upon and undertaken, incline toward welfare and happiness, then, having come to them, if you want more happiness in your life, you should stay with them and cultivate them. But still, how do you know? That's the question. How can I trust my thoughts? So many come through. And the thing is, you don't want to believe every thought coming through your head. You've probably seen where that gets you. But there are deeper places that those thoughts come from. Ajahn Chah says, to trust your Buddha knowing, that's the phrase that he used, trusting in your Buddha knowing, or Mahabua, another great Thai Ajahn, says, the one who knows, there's the one who knows inside. How do we get in touch with the one who knows, which is different than the superficial, you'd better not do this, don't blow it, come on, get on with it, kid. How do you know? First, it requires letting go of thinking about doing it right and spinning your wheels and particularly trying to figure out. It's one of the main practices, not figuring out. If you're somebody that likes to figure things out, let go of it. It's not going to do it. In that same Third Zen patriarch, he says, stop talking and thinking, and there's nothing you'll not be able to know. Then he says, as far as for all of those perfectionists out there, to live in the highest realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. That's when you know you've really made it, when you're willing to let go of being perfect and just experiment and explore, not figuring it out. I don't think I shared this with somebody on their first retreat. Did I talk about not figuring out? I don't know. Maybe. If so, here it is again. This woman who just was going around and around in her head trying to figure things out. And then the end of the retreat. The one thing that's indelibly fixed in my brain is finally getting, you don't have to figure it out. That would never have registered as an option before. Just today, I was doing walking meditation, struggling as my thoughts were going round and round. Those words came to my mind. I don't have to figure it out. I stopped and closed my eyes and asked myself, what is true right now in this moment? And what was true was the rising and falling of my breath and the various body sensations coming and going. And I thought to myself, the rest will balance itself out in its own time. And I resumed my walking. What a revelation. You don't have to figure it out. It all becomes clearer if you can patiently just look deeply and see the truth in this moment. And so that's one, because the mindfulness creates enough space when you let go of that figuring out mind for clarity to shine through. So that's one. A second one is learning how to listen. Learning how to listen to the wisdom that's right inside. So many decisions with each moment, what to do, what's the right thing to do, what's the right meditation, what should I do next? If you quiet down and listen, you can hear the Buddha right inside. And the image that I love for this is of the Tibetan iconography, the great yogi Milarepa. You can always tell the tanka of Milarepa, because Milarepa has his hand to his ear and he's listening to the song of the Dharma. There's a famous treatise, The 100,000 Dharma Songs of Milarepa, and he's just listening and listening. Not figuring out, but listening. How do you listen? How do you know what voice you can trust? I just invite you, make this more experiential for yourself. So many different voices coming through. How do you know which one or ones you can trust? You might think of some good decision you've made in the last days or in your life. How do you know that it was the one to trust and follow? Okay, you can open your eyes. I invite some comments. Again, if you want to share, then really say it out loud so I can hear it and then I can repeat it. How do you know inside? Say again? There's a trust and a faith and you just know. How do you know? What's that? There's a sense of peace. Okay, that's one thing. Say out loud. It feels kind, okay? Peaceful, kind. These then fleshing out this sense of trust and faith. It brings up wholesome qualities. You can feel the wholesomeness in it. Anything else? Yes. You have a really good logical reason to do something. Okay, you might have lots of good reasons to do something, but your heart tells you something else, and that's something you have to go. How do you know? What is your heart? How can you feel your heart? What does it feel like in there? Yeah. Okay, a quiet voice that you can't not hear, that you can't ignore. Anyone else? Yes. A certain amount of clarity that comes out of all of the confusion. Right. Maybe one more. Yes, in the back. Yes, yes. To be okay with not knowing, that's good. Yeah. Exploring it and just seeing. Okay, you also had your hand right over here. What does it feel like in your body? There's no contraction and no resistance, and I don't feel like I'm being forced. Yeah. Remember, I think it was the first talk I talked about the lazy man's guide about contraction and expansion, and the wholesome states have that quality of expansiveness. Your body doesn't lie, so you can feel it in your body, and also you can hear it in the tone of the voice. It's not coming through with a finger wag. You better not blow it, but there's a kindness and a peace and a trustable quality to it. So a lot of it is just really learning how to listen to the wisdom inside. Like I shared with you, those who were here in the Metta yesterday about Analio and the squirrels, you know, where these phrases aren't working, they're not working. Then he steps out of the kuti and he sees those baby squirrels rolling around. Oh, and then he says, this is it. This is what I need to follow, regardless of whatever the instructions were that he received. And you can trust that. You just know. And that's a big part of this trusting your knowing. Not trusting that you have the answers, but trusting that you can listen and feel the awareness in your body, in the tone, in your mind. And this is so in the meditation, and it's also so in your life. You can have all kinds of decisions to make, you know, and you don't want to make the wrong decision, but you also don't want to get stuck in just going around and around in your mind. I'll share with you a story I write about in my book. When I was at a crossroads in my life, I had been teaching school for public school, fifth and sixth grade, for a number of years in New York City. And I loved it for much of that time. I'm still in touch with students 50 years later. Mr. Barris, is that you? Those are the only people, by the way, that I call my students. And I loved it for quite some time. But towards the end, I had fallen in love with the Dharma, and it was getting a bit, it just wasn't fulfilling me. And for a few other reasons, it just seemed like I needed to do something else. But I was afraid to leave my secure job. I was making $17,000, which was big money for a single guy in the early 70s, mid-70s by that time. And but there were some other options. I'd sat my first three-month retreat. Maybe I'll go up to IMS and be on staff there, which was a possibility. Or maybe I'll finally take my Asian journey experience, like I heard my other teachers, and I had gone to, I didn't go to Asia yet at that point. That was another possibility. Or maybe I'll move out of New York, and there was a possibility of moving out to California. And all four seemed like good, reasonable choices. And I went around and around. I don't want to blow it. What's the right thing to do? And finally, in the summer, I'd be out in Colorado, Naropa, and I remembered I had gone to this psychic who was very wise. I'd visited him a couple of times before, and I said, I'll go see Reverend Miller. He'll tell me what to do. Reverend Miller, he looked exactly like Colonel Sanders, charged $5 for a reading, so you know he wasn't in it for the money, right? And I went to him and I said, Reverend Miller, help me. And I laid out my four choices, and I said, what should I do? And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I thought, oh, geez, $5 I just blew. he said, but I will tell you one thing. It doesn't matter. And I said, what do you mean it doesn't matter? That's my life you're talking about. And he believed in spirit guides. That was a big thing for him. And he said, you know, if you're just frozen in indecision, your guides can't help it. It can help you. You're just paralyzed. But once you start putting yourself in motion, what feels like the next thing to do, then your guides can help you. And you might go on one down one route and then see, oh no, that wasn't the right thing. I'll go do another one. Or you might go down that and it's perfect for you. Or you might start on that path and doors open in a way that you never could have imagined. So he says, any way you go, it doesn't matter. Your life is going to still unfold. And all you can do is listen to what your calling is in this moment and see. Best $5 I ever spent. So that's another thing, just kind of trusting what is my truth right now, even if it changes. Some other supports for practice. Here's a question to ask yourself. It's come up a number of times in our dialogues and in interviews. Just ask yourself, what do I need right now? And listen. Don't jump in with the answer. Listen for that that ring of truth inside. This is what I need. If you're asking in a way and then being milarepa and listening to the truth, it's right in there. This is what do I need to support my practice in this moment? So that's another support for practice. The refuges are tremendous support for getting out of your head and trusting. When you take refuge in the Buddha, that's what you're doing. You're taking refuge in the Buddha right inside of you. Whether or not you can contact them or access them, they're there. And if you quiet down enough and can be patient, then life will reveal itself. So taking refuge in the Buddha, your own Buddha nature, your own deep seed of awakening that is right inside, your bodhicitta, your awakened heart, this is a powerful refuge to know it's in you. Taking refuge in the Dharma, what does that mean? It means you're trusting in the unfolding and knowing that all you need to do is show up, and that's all you need to do. You can trust that your awareness can meet the moment. If you practice it here in this moment, chances are you'll be a whole lot more able to access it in the future. But if you're worried now about, will I be able to access it in the future, chances are when you get to the future, you're going to be worried about, oh, well, this is okay, but what about the future? And you miss out on connecting with your wisdom. That's what refuge in the Dharma is. For me, it's a very profound thing. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the way life is unfolding, and I can trust it and be with it instead of fight it. Just opening up to reality as it is. Ah, what can I learn? How can I sense how to meet this moment wisely? Refuge in the Sangha. Both our community here, where you see everybody else just doing their part with sincerity, it reminds you, all I need to do is show up with sincerity. And refuge in the Sangha also refers to the lineage of countless beings who've awakened over the last 2,500 years since the time of the Buddha. It works. This stuff works. And so to really have faith and trust in that, that the practice will lead you onward. Trusting in the process, even when you're in the middle of confusion, if you've touched some understanding for yourself before, don't forget that. Don't miss it. While you're in the middle of the next confusion, remember you got out of the last one as well and saw things that you hadn't seen before. I want to share with you a beautiful letter that a yogi who I've gotten to know very well wrote to herself on a retreat that she sat here on a month long. It's called Letter to My Future Self. Dear future me, caught in resistance, boredom, doubt, or self-doubt, etc., etc. I know it may not seem this way right now, but it's worth it. Really, really worth it. And it's working. And you're not doing it all wrong. In fact, you can't really not do it right. Your intention is powerful. Even if you may not recognize it at the moment, Sometimes it goes a bit undercover, but believe me, it's there, and that's all that matters. You're doing great, and you're wonderful, and I love you, and I'm so grateful that you're doing this, and I'm right there beside you with a lot of faith and compassion. Lean on it whenever you need it. All will be well. There is only one direction this can go. Letter to my future self. You might write a letter to that, like that, in your own mind, whether on paper or just to remind yourself when you've gotten through the storm and you said, wow, that was tough, but I sure learned a lot. Pull out that letter the next storm. A couple of more things and then we'll end. One is to lead with love. When all else fails, metta, to protect yourself, for self-compassion, to open your heart, and to get out of the figuring out mind. The Buddha taught that as the protection against danger, particularly inner harm as well as outer harm. And getting in touch with, as I said earlier, your sincerity of motivation. That's your greatest protection. And to just know you showing up is enough, and trusting in that process that life will keep on revealing itself to you if you are willing to open your eyes and learn. This is from the Buddha. His last words, or near his last words. Therefore, be ye lamps unto yourselves. Be a refuge to yourselves. Betake yourselves to no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth as a lamp. Hold fast to the truth as a refuge. Look not for a refuge in anyone besides yourselves. And those who either now or after I am dead shall be a lamp unto themselves, shall betake themselves to no external refuge, but holding fast to the truth, to the Dharma as their lamp, and holding fast to the truth as their refuge, shall not look for refuge to anyone besides themselves. It is they who shall reach the very topmost height. But they must be anxious to learn. So let's sit for a few moments. Tune into the Buddha right inside of you. For your attention. So we'll have a walking period, and once again, I think we'll do some chanting. We'll do the Anicca chant and offer another little treat at the end of the sitting. So see you at 9.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.